Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Our lecturer today is an author of large books. Although his books are large, they are extremely readable, highly entertaining and very instructive, full of information that you didn't know before, new ideas and new insights, and I thoroughly recommend them to you. His latest book is Life and Death of Democracy, which meets the description that I've just given to you, and I commend it to you if you can find it in the bookshops. And in addition to all that, he is also a bit of a character. Please welcome Professor John Keane to the podium.
Thank you very much, Harry, and I would like to thank you especially for the invitation to present this lecture here in the Senate, and also to David Sullivan, wherever David is. He's probably slipped out for all the background work that he did. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to float some ideas to you about the current state of media and the relationship between media and democracy, starting with the thought that we live in an age of communicative abundance. And as in every previous communication revolution, new products and processes are spawning tremendous fascination, fear, trembling, excitement. Inventions like satellite broadcasting, iPhones, electronic books, tweets, cloud computing, and also bold talk of online publics, of cyber citizens, of e-democracy, of wiki government in and around the Obama administration. And in the spirit of the revolution, there are many people who are suggesting or thinking that there is some kind of close affinity, almost a natural relationship between democracy and this new communicative abundance which is unfolding under our noses. And I would like to have a look at this presumption by, this is the most abstract idea in this lecture, by introducing an idea that was first developed almost a generation ago by a Canadian political economist named Harold Innes. He was the teacher of Marshall McLuhan, and he was also the teacher of my teacher. And Innes's idea, very simple but very profound, is that if you think about the history of communication media, you will see that every historical form of media structures people's sense of time and space. It's very simple, this is the abstract point. And if we were to take this idea up and think about democracy, which Innes didn't, nor did Marshall McLuhan, you could put on the table a rough working proposition, and it would go like this. The era of assembly democracy, for example, that which happened in Athens, sprang up in the era of the spoken word. That was the main medium of communication, orality. And with the help of messages carved in stone, or written on papyrus, and messages transmitted by foot or by donkey or horse. Democracy and speech were twins at the birth of democracy. The next historical phase, representative democracy, the kind of democracy that my grandparents knew, and yours too, sprang up in the era of print culture, the age of books, pamphlets, newspapers, telegraphed and mailed messages. And interestingly, they fell into crisis during the 1920s and 30s at the same time as the advent of mass broadcasting media, above all radio and cinema, and in its infancy, television. That's an interesting link which we could pursue, and I'll say something more about. I think since 1945, the world of democracy is changing. Has been changing, and we are moving into a third historical phase of democracy. I call it monitory democracy, the growth of not only the importance of elections and parties and so on, but other forms of monitoring, scrutiny, public scrutiny of power. I'll say more about this. And I think that this shift towards a new historical form of democracy in which elections remain important, but barking dogs and guide dogs and watchdog institutions are beginning to make politics a much more viral experience, much more rough and tumble, where governments and parties and parliaments are under pressure from public bodies that scrutinize their power, that this shift is associated with the rise of communicative abundance, with the growth, in other words, of multimedia saturated societies. So that if we were to explore this idea, then we could say that the days are probably over of broadcasting mass entertainment and representative democracy. The days, certainly, I recall from early years in South Australia when I and my sisters and brother were compulsorily flung into the bath and put into our dressing gowns on a Sunday evening and forced to sit down and listen to ABC radio and later TV. Those days are over. It wasn't altogether a pleasant experience, I seem to recall. And it is possible also that the age of demagogues using new broadcasting media, think of the relationship between radio and Hitler, it's also possible that those days are now over. Let me look then at the positive, exciting, intoxicating trends of our times. We're moving into a world of communicative abundance. We live in times in which there is something like a permanent contestation of power, permanent spats in public over who gets what, when, and how. It seems as if no organization or leader within the fields of government or social life is immune from political trouble. Global communication is becoming a reality. So too are global publics and global politics. The choice of how and when to communicate with others has become well entrenched. The shift from broadcasting to narrowcasting is a feature of our times. There are new wide divisions that have opened up between parties, parliaments, and the available means of communication. And of course, driving this is the emergence of the internet, plus satellite links, a new kind of galaxy of communication which effectively break down space-time differences. Think of the arrest of Governor Bligh on the 26th of January 1808. It took until September for London to find out that that arrest had taken place. Such is the difference from the age of representative democracy. And this is the first historical era, you all know well, in which sound, image, and text are now integrated through multimedia channels in which millions of people can access this galaxy of communication from multiple points scattered across the globe. And all this means that the standard institutions of democracy, parliaments, courts, and so on, are increasingly enveloped in the world of this, in this new world, emerging world, of communicative abundance. And the consequence is, despite some of the trends that I'm going to speak about, that nothing seems to be sacrosanct. I think our grandparents and great-grandparents would find the whole process really astonishing in its democratic intensity and its global scale. To capture this, of course, one has to look at some examples. For instance, this is the era in which a government minister, a foreign minister, in fact, in the Scandinavian region, text messaged a lover, he was married, and was found out and forced to resign. This is the era in which a citizens' initiative, among the zaniest in the London scene, is space hijackers. I don't know if you know about space hijackers. They're famous for doing things like going to the City of London and drinking in wine bars with bankers, for instance, on a Friday night, and then going and playing cricket with them at midnight in the City of London. And their most famous action, making full use of this multimedia saturation process, is to attend an arms fair in London's Docklands driving a tank. And that was an astonishing piece of media politics that many people spoke about for many weeks afterwards. These are also times during elections, for instance, when Sony handheld cameras are used by our off-air reporters known as embeds to file ongoing videos and blogs featuring candidates live, unplugged, and unscripted. And this is, of course, the age in which video footage proves that soldiers in war zones raped women, terrorized children, and tortured innocent civilians. So communicative abundance, you could say, this new galaxy of media helps to cut like a knife into the power relations of both government and civil society. And it's little wonder that public objections to wrongdoing and corruption become commonplace. I'm sure that in my lifetime, the number and the frequency of scandals has grown exponentially. And it's almost as if you draw from this media and think globally about it, it's as if there is a scandal a day. Some revelation, some thing that happened in private is revealed in this multimedia saturated mediascape that generates scandals. These gate scandals, and recently we've just had one, it turns out, I think remind us that in the age of monitory democracy, there is still much manipulation. Many things are decided behind closed doors in the shadows of power. That's all true. And yet, it does seem to me that the whole viral quality of politics in our times has a lot to do with the dynamics of this trend towards multimedia saturation. And it's as if power disputes are constantly going on and they follow surprising pathways. There is even, in our times, the emergence of bodies like the Global Accountability Project or Transparency International, or like the Democratic Audit Networks that specialize in monitoring both media and the quality of democracy. So this is, I think, a very significant trend that ought to cheer any small D Democrat up. Now, I'm kangaroo hopping through many, many pages because the suggestion, if you think along these lines, of this tight affinity between multimedia saturated societies, communicative abundance, and democracy, is that it looks like this trend towards the open scrutiny of power, the emphasis on accountability, integrity, is being underwritten by these media. And it's as if all of the king's horses and all of the king's men are unlikely to reverse the trend, or so there are good reasons for thinking. Now, it's, I think, worth adding the counter-trend, because if I am right about this trend, parties, parliaments, elected politicians are suffering for the time being under the pressures of these trends towards communicative abundance. Sometimes I think they've been caught with their pants down in many democracies. Parliaments, for instance, have relatively limited media presence. They haven't gotten into the game. It's as if they're sidelined. Parties, interestingly, this is a generational change, neither own nor control their media outlets, unless you're Mr. Berlusconi, about whom I'll say something in a moment. Rude. Politicians are given a permanently hard time by journalists. And so I submit that the public disaffection with politicians, with political parties and parliaments, and official politics in general, a trend that's, I would say, widespread in every actually existing democracy, is bound up with this transition towards communicative abundance. Some people say that the 2008 election victory of Barack Obama proves otherwise, but I find that unconvincing, exactly because Mr. Obama is, I think, the first great elected representative of our times to get the hang of the new, entirely new dynamics, to grasp, in other words, that politicians, parties, legislatures, and the whole governments have to adopt new tactics, new rhetorical styles that work with and not against the kaleidoscope or the viral qualities of politics in the age of monetary democracy. And Mr. Obama may also be, we shall see during the coming months, the first great elected representative to be skewered by these dynamics, because the difficulties he's currently experiencing show that in the era of monetary democracy, political communication is constantly the subject of dissembling, of negotiation, of compromise, of power conflicts, in a phrase, a matter of politics. Now, I want to depress you slightly by beginning to talk about the other trends, the decadent trends, and I'm carefully using the term decadence because it has a long history in the English language, comes from the Latin, and it's typically the flip side of luxury. So to put it simply, if we are living in times in which there is a kind of luxury of communicative abundance, the ease of communication, the multiple channels and so on, then the darker side, the negative side, is that of decadence. The word, therefore, is not just a trope, it's a careful attempt to look at some of the negative trends in the field of media in our own time. Some of these trends are much talked about and pretty obvious. For instance, the development of media saturation can profusion, if you like, can breed confusion. Lots of people switch off. And there are some studies of this, people who stop reading newspapers, who stop accessing the internet simply because they can't stand the bombardment and feel that they have better things to do with their lives. That is a dangerous trend for democracies because it's as if, perhaps like ostriches, they begin to stick their heads into the sands of willful ignorance, or they float cynically upon the swirling tides and waves and eddies of fashion. And they change their minds, they speak and act flippantly, they embrace or celebrate opposites. They don't care much about what's going on or whether it's true or not, and they therefore become vulnerable to slipping into the arms of what contemporary philosophers, Harry Frankfurt is the best known, one of America's leading philosophers, and Australians in general call bullshit. Bullshit is a kind of, you know, media products, media experience, where questions of truth, veracity, no longer matter. You just go along floating like flotsam and jetsam on the tides, and you don't care. That's very dangerous for democracy because ignorance, illusions, and so on can easily play into the hands of political dissemblers. So it's possible, when you look at a trend like this, that after all, the king's horses and all the king's men might be capable of undoing democratic accountability. That is to say, it's possible that media decadence can have corrosive effects on democracy. Now, what exactly do I have in mind, mindful of the time left? I could discuss at least a handful of these trends, but I want to just concentrate on two. They're trends that I think are deep-seated in Australia, but they're not uniquely Australian. They're trends for which there are possible remedies, creative inventions, new institutions that could in fact reverse these trends. There's nothing inevitable about them. I think you will recognize these two decadent trends when I begin to talk about them. But they're trends that are certainly worrying, and they ought to worry us because, analogous to the trends that emerged in the 20s and 30s of the 20th century, they bode ill for democracy. What are these trends? The first that I want to talk about, and it's not a very pretty word, is to talk about the trend towards a certain medievalization of communication, the development of medieval qualities. And in particular, I'm thinking about the development of forms of enclosure, closed spaces which are not publicly accessible. Now, what is driving these trends? towards a medievalization. You know that we're waiting the release in a court in Adelaide of a young man who was charged with infecting, who's been charged with infecting more than 3,000 computers around the world with a virus designed to capture banking and credit card data. But this relatively small case reminds us that in the age of communicative abundance, acts of unauthorized interference, otherwise known as hacking, are becoming chronic. I could describe in detail an extraordinary media event which currently grips France, which has all of the viral qualities that are typical of our age of communicative abundance. I don't know if you know about this, but briefly, it's an example of hacking in action on a big scale. And it started quite by accident featuring the American cycling champion, Floyd Landis, who was accused of doping. And the tests were actually hacked in the laboratory. It seems in his defense, he was disgraced. But when the French cyber police looked at the hacker's computer, they discovered all these other characters, including Greenpeace activists, including the media and telecommunications conglomerate Vivendi, and including Electricité de France, the main electricity supplier, which also has big interests in the UK. So what they uncovered, quite by accident, thanks to Floyd Landis, is a whole private hacking into databases for the purpose of manipulation and spying and surveillance. And none of this, as the judge leading the inquiry, it's not over, is pointing out that these so-called Trojan horse attacks are worrying for democracy. And it is possible that they are the prelude of much more sophisticated, automated targeting of the cloud of information that people and organizations generate through their online activities, that this might well become the norm. And if this becomes the norm, then this is worrying for the principle of freedom of communication and open accountability of institutions. I think this is not a specifically French problem, but what it's generating, as Jonathan Zittrain says in, I think, a very fine book on the future of the internet, an American scholar based at Harvard, is that it's exactly this experience of hacking, of spam, that wonderful word that's become popularized. I think its roots are spiced ham, Harry would know, and famously popularized by Monty Python in a sketch, you know, the restaurant where there's only spam on the menu. It's the experience of spam, of hacking, the invasion of databases that, according to Zittrain, is producing a kind of security mentality in this galaxy of communicative abundance. That is, a tendency to produce gated communities, tethered communication tools that actually begin to interfere with the whole process of open communication, which is fundamental for democracy. And his example, I'm sorry if this is personally offensive to some of you, and those of you who know me know that I don't have one, but for him, the iPhone is a wonderful, beautiful tool that combines multiple functions, but it is an example, a symbol of where the internet is going. It is a sterile tool. You can't use it for generative purposes, unlike, for example, a personal computer, which you can do all sorts of weird and wonderful things with if you know, for example, how to write software, but you cannot, with this iPhone, do anything very innovative. You are restricted to its internal structure. Now, this trend, Zittrain thinks, is a trend towards something like the privatization of ownership and control of communication media. I've described it as medievalization. I mean, take your pick, but it's this development of, instead of an open, which was the great hope at the beginning of the internet, this open communicative abundance, this development of pockets, of areas where there is no free entry unless you pay for it, and typically involve exclusions. Now, the trend is undoubtedly being, in my view, this decadent trend is undoubtedly being driven by market conditions. The decision recently of News Corporation to charge online readers for all of its news sources, such as The Times in the UK or Fox News or Papua New Guinea's Post Courier, or the move announced just last week by more than 500 newspapers and magazines to join a new initiative that is called Journalism Online. It's a portfolio of news from various providers, websites, and electronic platforms. These sorts of trends, which are to do with profitability, are actually also gating the internet, so that you will have to pay if you want to access the Times of London very shortly, and you will have to pay for increasing numbers of news sources and other forms of entertainment. Now, this is fine, except that the ability to pay induces a kind of inequality, which is not good for democracy. Now, I don't want to belabor that point, but this is the first trend, this decadent trend towards the medievalization, the growth, the privatization of communication media. And it does raise the question, in policy terms, of what could be done to prevent this. And just one little thought, the world, I mean it, the world has no equivalent in the early years of the 21st century of the great idea that was born in the 1920s in relation to radio and then later television of public service media. I mean, it's the great Reithian idea. In the 1920s, radio, this new medium, it was clear to contemporaries, could be used, as Mussolini thought, for total state control along the fascist line. It could be used, as the Bolsheviks showed, for the Bolshevization of the world. There was the market American option, and Reith came up, for the reasons that are known well, with an entirely different business model, we would say today, a different structure for this new media, and it came to be called, of course, public service media, of which the ABC is an offspring. We have very few equivalents in the 21st century, and that should be worrying, given this first trend. Second trend, and then I shall stop because I'm going to overstay my welcome and you'll all leave and there'll be no discussion, is that is to do with the growing problem of government media management. But I want to throw some new light on this. This is, of course, an Australian problem, as we shall see. The ownership of the means of communication, of course, remains crucial in the 21st century. Large corporate control of media remains a problem for democracy, as it did in the era of representative democracy. The thumbs of giant conglomerates like Bertelsmann and News Corporation and Vivendi are all over the monetary democracy and its media infrastructure of our times. Ben Bagdikian, an American scholar, has shown that there is this trend, for instance, in America towards the concentration of ownership. It's worth repeating the data. 1984, there were some 50 large companies in the United States that controlled most media. By 1987, 50. By 1987, that number had dropped to 26. 1996 dropped further to around 10. By 2004, there were only five, a big five: Time Warner, Disney, Bertelsmann, News Corporation, and Viacom. And these five companies now control the lion's share of the media industry. And that, of course, makes governments vulnerable to the power of this concentrated media. For example, the oligopoly in Australia, about which you know many things. And it produces incidents, manipulations, dissembling that is not good for democracy. I'm staying in the Kurrajong, where many things happened historically, including a meeting you may know early in January 1968, when Harold Holt disappeared, where the question for Black Jack McEwen, leader of the Country Party, I remember him from my childhood, acting Prime Minister, had the job of knowing that a Country Party figure could not govern the country, had the job of deciding between two key candidates. As you know, John Gorton was the winner, and Billy McMahon, whom Black Jack McEwen despised. They met, you may know, they met in the Kurrajong. That is, Black Jack McEwen met with Rupert Murdoch. to discuss which candidate would be the one. And as you may remember, to put it very, very simply, the two of them in the Kurrajong decided that Gorton was their man, and they got rid of Billy McMahon effectively by claiming that his main confidant, Max Newton, was a Japanese foreign agent. And the Murdoch papers were splashed all over with this event. And that can happen when you have conglomerates, large conglomerates, and oligopolies. And if you have a monopoly, as in Italy, then you can more or less do anything you like to dissemble and to undo the best qualities of democracy. Now, Italy is an example which we could talk about in detail. I don't have time. But what I want to say, actually, is that this is not, this trend towards corporate manipulation of governments is not in any way comparable to the 1920s and the 1930s. I don't think Berlusconi is, for example, somehow a repeat of that experience. And I want to say that the growing integration of government and commercial media, which is this second trend, is evident in all sorts of contexts. You can see it in China, you can see it in Iran, you can see it in Russia. But the shocking thought that I want to put on the floor is that this decadent trend, where governments become deeply implicated in the communicative abundance, and they begin to manipulate and structure the dynamics, shut down, in effect, freedom of communication. This trend, well advanced in China, well advanced in Russia, going on in Iran, going on in Italy, is actually a problem that has taken root in virtually every monitory democracy. Now, the process is often talked about as spin. And what I want to try to convince you of in my remaining time is that it's much more complicated and insidious than that, that it has two sides, beginning with the top-down process. The top-down process is that governments, of course, have increasingly sophisticated ways of handling journalists. I think John Howard did this to a remarkably and worryingly unconventional degree. It's going on, however, all over the place, and Tony Blair certainly did it. I want to just say that in his farewell speech about media, you may remember for Reuters, Tony Blair went on about the feral beast of the media, and he created this picture that journalists are rotten buggers. You know, they're constantly causing us problems. Let me quote from this speech, because I think it's part of the camouflage, really, of the dynamics. "When I fought the 1997 election," said Blair in this speech, "we took an issue a day. In 2005, we had to have one for the morning, another for the afternoon, and by the evening, the agenda had already moved on. You have to respond to stories also in real time," he added. "Frequently, the problem is as much assembling the facts as giving them. Make a mistake, and you quickly transfer from drama into crisis. In the 1960s, the government would sometimes, on a serious issue, have a cabinet lasting 2 days. It would be laughable to think you could do that now without the heavens falling in before lunch on the first day. Things harden within minutes. I mean, you can't let speculation stay out there for longer than an instant." And, he concluded, "you know, we're living in times where governments have to put their armor on. Quote, not to have a proper press operation nowadays is like asking a batsman to face bodyline bowling without pads or headgear." I'm sure Mr. Blair had a point, but I think one difficulty with this view that governments are under siege from, you know, a feral beast media is that it ignores the way in governments themselves are involved in increasingly clever, cunning attempts to kidnap their citizens. Blair, I think, the Blair government took this somehow to current perfection. They fed, the government fed leaks and exclusives often. Exclusives. You can have this, but only if you put it on page one. When embarrassing stories broke, they put out decoys. They denied, and they certainly lied, openly, brazenly. And they also mastered the art of releasing bad news on busy days. That was called around the Blair government, Alistair Campbell, throwing out the bodies, sometimes throwing out the dead bodies, release bad news when there are a lot of good news and other things going on. So governments are doing this, and I think research in universities, and it's not happening in the field of journalism, needs to look carefully at these trends and to think about them historically, because they are deep-seated and they bode ill for democracy. And there's no doubt that the tactics are getting cleverer, and they're very simple. Why do they work? This is the second dimension of this second decadent trend. Because it seems to me a problem with Blair's view of the feral beast media and a problem with using the word spin is that government manipulation from above of media requires the connivance and the support of journalists and churnalism, as it is being called. It's a neologism of our times, and it's well been analysed, I think. I urge you to read it if you haven't. The book by Nick Davies, a journalist in the UK, called Flat Earth News. And the gist of Nick Davies' Flat Earth News is this, that the reason why governments can get away with things is because journalists no longer, it's a generalization, no longer tend to work off diary. They no longer have the time to go out and find their own stories. They no longer have the time to check the material which they're handling. And the consequence is they repeat stories endlessly, and they actually don't know what they're doing. This is not an ad hominem or feminine remark. It's just they don't have time, because such are the conditions of being a journalist. And the consequence, as Nick Davies points out, and this is a worry for democracy, is that media, journalists, become vulnerable to ingesting and reproducing packages of information and stories which are both supplied to them by government and also by the PR industry. I have noticed since being in Australia, if you watch certain news channels, better watch it here, you will find there are many items that are actually straight PR jobs. You know, a PR firm just contacts them, gives them the interviewee, tells them the story, and they just do it. It's very cheap, but it's not anything like investigative journalism. I think that the worrying consequence, effect of this, is that the media, rather like a human body without an immune system, becomes vulnerable to lots of distorted pseudo-news or pseudo-coverage about pseudo-events. That's what Nick Davies calls flat earth news. And worryingly, it's a really important topic for Democrats to think about, is that this kind of journalism produces silences. And silences are very hard to spot until something happens that has very negative effects. One example, the fact that for over 30 years, journalism in general, media overall, failed to blow the whistle on a culture, bank, credit institution leveraging that went on and produced a ginormous bubble. The fact that they did not blow the whistle on this systematically is an example of flat earth news. A silence built up until the bubble began to burst, bringing some part of the world to the cliff edge of a major depression. Now, I better stop because we'll have no time for discussion, but I want to just draw it all together. Here's a new topic, but we all know about it, and it's just, you know, public intellectual finding new words to describe what you already talk about, and I'm sorry for that, but the problem of media decadence is, it seems to me, a deep-seated and growing problem in the age of communicative abundance. We could say, well, so what? Well, it doesn't much matter, you know. Isn't it the case that there's always been this kind of irresponsibility, this kind of silence, this kind of getting things wrong? And when I talk to people, particularly of the older generation, they say, really old generation, they say things like, well, you know, in the spring of 45, summer 45, it was widely reported in most press that Hitler was a peasant in Italy, that he became a fisherman in Ireland, that he'd gotten on a submarine and traveled to Spanish America and so on. It was all nonsense. But, you know, for some weeks there was this deliberate circulation of stories. Well, I think it is an old problem, but the point that I want to put to you is that this media decadence, this growth of the privatization, the medievalization of the galaxy, internet galaxy, and this tendency for government and corporate media to merge, lubricated by this problem of journalism, is of a very grave importance in the 21st century, simply because there is a growing number of problems that have a very large footprint, that go well beyond territorial states, and that can bring grave consequences. These problems can produce grave consequences if they are not regulated, if they are not talked about, if they are not covered. And the closing thought is a thought on this score is a thought that more than four decades ago, an American psychologist named Irving Janis spoke about as groupthink. He pointed out that if you look at the American invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, which was a disaster, actually the thing that made it disastrous was the groupthink that went into the decision, which was done entirely in private, no public scrutiny, no public controversy. I think there's a growing number of these political decisions and problems where groupthink is at work. I have no doubt that the invasion and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan is a case in point, and I have no doubt that, I say this rhetorically, it's much to be discussed, but the giant market bubble that developed is a consequence of a certain groupthink that pervaded both the market economy and the field of government. Now, if the problem of groupthink can produce policy disasters, and if these policy disasters' footprint is expanding, that they affect the lives of ever greater numbers of people, then it seems to me that the problem of groupthink ought to be at the center of our discussions of media, politics, and democracy. And it's a reason for thinking positively about their toxic effects and what can be done about them. The point is that the free circulation of differing viewpoints, of bold conjectures, of corrective judgments, of checks and balances, the humbling of power, is the best remedy for this media decadence and the kinds of negative effects that they have. I think this is more than enough for a lunchtime on Friday, and I would be very glad to have comments and questions. I never did this before, and I'm trying now to write something about this. It's all a bit from the heart, all a bit unthought out, but I would greatly value a conversation and getting a bit of stick. Thank you very much.
Well, that was a model of brevity. We do have time for some questions, so questions, comments? Could I ask any questions to go to the microphones? Could you trot across to the microphone in the centre of the aisleway here? Yes, come to the microphone. The microphone over here.
Thank you. I enjoyed very much. Was very stimulated by your lecture, and in particular, your point at the end about groupthink. And the dangers that causes and how that might best be addressed, reminded me that addressing that very question of groupthink, a fellow called Barack Obama, who you mentioned earlier, is now the president, wrote in Audacity of Hope quite extensively about his solution, if you like, to groupthink. And he wasn't raising a new idea, but he talked at some length about the concept of deliberative democracy, mm-hmm. by which he explained that was going way beyond representative democracy and was rather a form of democracy that we should be moving towards rapidly, a form of consultation, of reaching out, of actually, he actually said there should be no absolute truths. We should no longer have any certainty that anything is truly correct. We should rather create mechanisms of government and so on whereby every proposition is able to be tested out, debated, looked at some length. And his mentioning of deliberative democracy was referring to an intellectual concept, which I'm sure you know, has been around, you know, for decades, or at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it struck me, as you were speaking, how does that concept, which seems to have some similarities with your monitoring democracy, how do those two fit together? Mm-hmm. And do you approve of or support one rather than the other, or you think they're complementary? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I can be very brief. Thank you very much. I mean, it's good for democracy that there is public deliberation about who gets what, when, and how. Without that, democracy withers away. Public, non-violent, open, commentary, tussling about options and deciding, helping to decide those with the assistance of citizens and representatives, no problem. In the book, I have a little twist, however, to give to this, which is that I think it's all too seminarish. It's what I do half the time. It's good chaps and good women who speak well in public about things. And I, so there should be more of it. And you particularly, one should think that in those nasty moments where rumors are circulated through media and there's a lot of bullshit, it's at that point that one craves for deliberation. But it does seem to me that the deliberative democracy trend in academia and some of the policy experiments that are going misunderstands itself. My view is that it comes about, you say rightly, during the last 10 years, because actually there is this historical shift that's going on. It's one symptom of this trend towards forms of public monitoring of power that include deliberation but are also much more rough and tumble. Small example, favorite one, on the day that Gordon Brown is fielding questions in Prime Minister's time in the House of Commons in London, a group called Plain Stupid, P-L-A-N-E, stupid, it's a joke, protesting about a new runway at Terminal 5 on the grounds at Heathrow, on the grounds it's already big enough, it's an environmental cesspool, and we don't need it. Manage with the help of some unnamed members of Parliament to actually get into the House of Commons and get up on the roof of the House of Commons and conduct their own, unfurl their banners, and conduct their own media interview with the pack down below a couple of hundred feet using mobile phones. And in his earpiece, the Prime Minister is informed that there's a demonstration going on the top of the House. And he says, in a very dour way, I remind the honourable members that policy in this country is made under the roof of this house and not on the roof of the house. In fact, that's a little symbol, I think, of this shift. I mean, is this deliberative democracy? Hardly. It's a kind of staged, you know, media event where Plain Stupid knows that, I mean, having contacted journalists, that they will actually come, and it got widely reported. And you know which item was lead item in the 10:30 news. It's Plain Stupid up there. It's wonderful. So I think it's more rough and tumble than that. And I think politicians, parties, governments have to get used to that. It's just part of the new landscape, and it's probably good for democracy, even if you don't like Plain Stupid.
Now, we have a questioner upstairs, speaking of on the roof.
John, I'm a mature age student of politics and I have been enjoying these series. I've got a question for you, and that is, do you believe the use of media, of comedy, and I'm thinking of like episodes like Yes Minister, which I do enjoy, conditions our collective consciousness to accepting mediocrity?
Yeah.
Don't know. I think we'd have to have a good discussion about this genre of programs, and it's a moving. They move fast. And some are of very high quality. I mean, this, which you mentioned, is attracts a large audience and politically educates, I think, many more people than the 10 o'clock news or what have you. And I have an open mind about that. And we come back, in a way, to the deliberative democracy thing. I don't have a, you know, very straight-jacketed realist view of what counts as public education or citizens' involvement or citizens, you know, learning about power and politics can certainly be done through these media. And, you know, we could extend this analysis to include music and theatre and so on. And I realise it's a big and overwhelming topic at this point, but because it's all part of this mediascape. But yeah, the point then is to have a plurality of these programmes or genres, not just one, so there is choice, but also for producers and directors and so on to actually think about what they're doing and actually be inventive in the way that, you know, they can communicate with audiences. Certainly, you know, in Britain, the rescue of the NHS was bound up with a nightly drama set in the NHS. It did much more than any politician's speeches or, you know, white papers or documents to make people realize that actually, you know, life in the NHS is quite interesting, but it's also life and death, and it's worth rescuing if we don't want to go down the path of the United States.
Now, there was a lady in the front row here. Did you have a question? Would you like to come to the microphone?
You said you were going to depress us. Thank you. You've done that very well, for me anyway.
Yeah, or you don't look very depressed.
No. I was a little bit surprised, actually, because I would have thought that more was essentially better. Are you saying, effectively, that less media is more back in the good old days? Or do you think that things like Twitter, Facebook, citizen journalism, blogs, those sorts of things actually have an active role to play and are doing that now, which tends to override those people who are ambivalent and checking out that you mentioned before? I think there's something valid in those forms of media. You know, where is the glimmer of hope in your assessment for media and democracy?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly, I mean, even if we wanted to turn the clock back to the era of ABC radio and dressing gowns and so on, I mean, forget it, it's over. And it's a stronger statement, the age of demagogues, you know, doing stand-up performances before adoring masses is over. Simply because of the different structure, the dynamics of this galaxy of communication, which I'm calling communicative abundance. And from this point of view, it's, I think, very hard to conceive in a new way what public service media means in the 21st century. To make it clear, democracies do thrive when there is a strong sense of democracy as the public ownership of the means of decision making. I don't know if you've ever thought about democracy like that. It's very simple. When people privatize the means of decision making, that's bad for democracy. An election is a publicly owned act. It's a publicly owned spectacle. It's a publicly owned experience. No company runs it or shouldn't run it, and no particular group should control it. That's called corruption. That's what happened in the 19th century and so on. But analogously, if democracy is understood in this way as public ownership of the means of decision making, then a healthy complement of this is the public ownership of communication media. And for me, that's slipping away. And yes, it's true, there are lots of countertrends. It's in the blogosphere, it seems to me, that a lot of things are happening. It's almost It's not a very good metaphor, but the media conglomerates, the standard areas of television and print culture and radio, are experiencing this kind of subterranean stream or river that's flowing, and it's kind of corroding, and the land is collapsing. And that's probably a good thing, but the question is, in this process, can using, for example, these phenomena of citizen journalists and Twitter and blogs and so on, can these somehow result in a strengthening of the principle of public ownership and access of media? I think that's a very ill thought out and in policy terms very underdeveloped initiative or trend. But it's vital for the future of democracy.
Yeah, yeah. And so you look at, just very recently in the United States, recently written about, you know, ProPublica is an initiative, online initiative, and it's exactly this attempt. Another example, I'll stop, the whole question of scanning and electronically developing a library, a global library of books, is at the moment in the American courts, and Yahoo and Google and Microsoft are all bound up in a huge dispute about who will own this information and who will control access to it. This is a lot of unfinished business, and it's very exciting, but it's also rather scary, because you can see in this dispute about, you know, who will own and control the world's literature, and should there be an oligopolistic structure, or should there be some equivalent to the BBC in it? This is really a very vital matter for the future of democracy, and this is unfinished business. I mean, watch that court case, because it's really important.
Now, there was a question over there. Can you gallop to the microphone?
Thanks for your talk. You used discussion about war for a number of your case examples in the talk, and at the end mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm. There's been a lot of debate about the Iraqi war, but how does your theory of superabundant media explain the almost complete absence of any debate about the Afghan war, which Australia's been at war there for 7 years now, and I just don't really understand how there can be so little debate on it, but I look for your views on that.
I think this twin lethal combination of a now nearly decade-long history of government information and, I mean, structuring of the debate and justification of the policy, which is all a mess at the moment. It started out that it was to do with the war on terror. I mean, the invention of the war on terror, you have to go to Afghanistan and you have to knock them out. There's been a phase of talking of democratization, and I've blotted my copybook this week, mainly on ABC, saying just forget that. You know, it's just not about that, and actually it's a failure in both cases. So why are we there? So it's partly government and it's partly journalism. And the fact is, it's very dangerous work. I mean, there is an Australian journalist best known for his work on Afghanistan. Very dangerous work. But the consequence is, we're told stories that don't seem to arouse the sense of the dangers and complexity and probable failures of these interventions. The coverage of the election in Afghanistan initially, I thought it was like reading about an election in Britain, until you realize that the turnout is less than a third. There are 500 or 700 major bomb blasts and a lot of people killed, in which Karzai, it's not a party political remark, you know, one of his mates is called the Butcher, field commanders, clustered around the government, where there's a bounty. It was $50,000 on a dead or alive member of parliament. I mean, what kind of democracy is this? So, you know, that doesn't come through very well. I'm sorry to, you know, be a party spoiler, but it does seem to me that, you are right to raise, I mean, war is a test case of this, and it's the media silences that develop that need to be explained, and they're not good for democracy. War being one of its main corrosive enemies. I mean, the history of democracy is full of examples where democracies are knocked off very quickly because of war and violence and the involvement in war and violence.
Now, a last question, perhaps.
I see we stick to a very strict time schedule.
Strict, so thank you very much for your address. I was interested in the aspect of information rich, information poor. It seems to me that you have addressed the information rich, or even with censored societies like China. What of the vast majority of the population of the world that have no access at all to telecommunications?
Yeah, I caught here. I mean, I actually had it. It will eventually go online when I keep Harry happy and it's put up. But there was a section, and I've written a bit about that, and I think you're right. It's another decadent trend. This dualization is a bit more complicated, but information poverty is the cliche. Most of the world's population is too poor to make a telephone call. A minority, small minority of the world has access to the internet. Come on. There are more telephones, mobiles in Tokyo than in the whole of Southern Africa, and so on, you know, this kind of thing. That figure is debatable. And the question is what to do about it. And I think we'd need to talk about so what? Who cares? Well, it turns out that the information rich have an interest in what's going on in the information poor zones. They're zones of war and climate change and so on that directly impinge on us. And I think globalization, I mean, requires, you know, intelligent media coverage of these, so that's a key reason. It's also interesting to look at the initiatives. One laptop per child is an interesting example of how you try to overcome this. But it's got a long way to go.
If there is
That's, by the way, sorry, it's also, you know, this is not just a north-south problem. This is also the case within rich democracies. And, a democracy, a monetary democracy like Britain, has now nearly 30% of its under-18 population living in poverty. That's really astonishing. That's government, they are government figures, by the way. And this cohort is certainly information poor. You might think that it's up to its ears in iPhones, but that's not so. And that's very bad for the future of democracy if the next generation has been steeped in the experience of poverty and this information poverty as well. That's not good. And so that is a matter of redistribution, and I mean, I think policy innovation to overcome that. And I mean, there are various ways of doing it, of which the one laptop per child or the transformations going on in education are very important. But I have no intelligent things to say about that. I need to pay more attention to it.
Unless we have one very eager questioner willing to be extremely brief, I think we have to call a halt. Our guest has to catch a plane. So let's join up in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating lecture.
Thank you very much.